We're glad you're here this evening and that you will be continuing with us in our study of the greatest of all sermons, the Sermon on the Mount. Tonight we will be discussing principally verses 38 through 48 of the fifth chapter of Matthew, Matthew 5, 38 to 48. But I want you to remember, as we began the study tonight, the Beatitudes. I want you never to forget the Beatitudes. As a description of the spirit, disposition, inclination of heart of those who are citizens in this kingdom. And also to remember the similitudes, the calling of such people to be that which they are as a consequence of their disposition in the grace of God, salt to a generation that is decaying in sin and light to those who are stumbling in the darkness. That is a high calling. We are not worthy of it, but God can take the humblest of instruments, if the Spirit is right, and turn it into something that is transcendently valuable. And I want you to remember the attitude of the kingdom citizen toward God and His Word, as verse 19 has taught us in the fifth chapter. We cannot treat loosely the least commandment if we want to be accepted into this kingdom, because the Father is behind all those commandments. And in our disposition toward His Word, we reveal our disposition toward Him. And then I want us to look again at these six contrasts that we have been studying. I have said already that the contrast is not between the law of Moses and the teaching of Christ. He has just been telling us that not the least part of the law and the prophets shall fail of fulfillment, and that these people to whom he addressed himself, this Jewish audience who is at that moment under that law, should not despise or neglect the least commandment that is there. Now, he will not suddenly turn and say, now that's what Moses said, but that's not right. I'm telling you how it really is. The 20th verse has taught us, as a preface, that what he's talking about here is the corruption of the law through the Pharisees. Their mindless, shallow, superficial righteousness that has its foundation, this terrible corruption of what the law of Moses really said. It is a contrast between their total misunderstanding of the righteousness of God and his own expression of it as the King of the kingdom, as an expression of gospel law, as gospel truth. Having said that, we indicated that the whole of these six contrasts has behind it one undergirding principle. And that principle is, and you will remember it well, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You will recognize that later on in the concluding part of the sermon, he will say, as you would therefore that men should do to you, do you even so to them. And that is an expression of this Old Testament precept, the second greatest of all, Leviticus 19:18, that we are to love our neighbor. He begins by helping us deal with evil in ourselves. If we want to love our neighbors, there are certain dispositions that have got to be cut out. You can't treat people that way. And the first taught us that it's hateful anger, not just murder, that we need to wrestle with. Hateful anger that issues in hard, bitter words that wound and hurt, and that will bring you under condemnation from God. As he says it plainly, you are in danger of the hell of fire. And then we learn, too, that we must recognize not just adultery, which was the fascination of the teaching of the Pharisees, but that lust is the problem. Don't covet your neighbor's wife, says the 10th commandment of the 10. Don't let your heart run amok. Do not release yourself to think and imagine all kinds of lascivious things about others. He said it is hellish. It is wrong. And so he urges us to the purity of heart that Christians must struggle to find by his grace. I say again, we are living in an age that makes that exceedingly difficult, but far from impossible. And for us, it is an imperative. And then we looked at another, where the Pharisees were concerned about the niceties of the divorce law, that everybody who divorced his wife should be careful to give her a bill or writing of divorcement. And Jesus said, that is not the issue. The Old Testament, God to the Jews, did not encourage divorce. He said in Malachi that he hated putting away. But he did regulate it. And Deuteronomy 24 is such a regulation. But the Pharisees had missed the point entirely. Isolating this one statement from all the rest of the Scripture, forgetting that you cannot take, when you put away a wife, having found some unseemly thing in her, give her a writing of divorcement, you can't cut that away from and isolate that from, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And so he says, I say to you, that whoever puts away his wife, except or saving for the cause of fornication, sexual immorality, makes her an adulteress, and whoever marries her commits adultery. And I will stress again tonight that you better remember, we all need to remember, the Beatitudes. When it comes to the way we treat our covenanted marriage mates, and that we are only deceiving ourselves when we conclude that this marriage in which I find myself so unhappy, I can break as long as I do not plan to take another marriage mate. You can forget that. When you put away a faithful wife, whatever the problems are, and she goes to another man, you are a partner in her adultery. And the Lord will hold you and hold me accountable for that betrayal. We did not say so much about this one. But the Lord's still dealing with trouble inside of us. The Pharisees were concerned about perjury. I think what we need to say tonight is that the Lord dealt with oath-taking in much the same way as he dealt with divorce, so it seems to me. He did not initiate oath-taking. He did not command people to take an oath. But he did say, when you swear, you are to swear by the Lord. You're not to swear by the heathen gods. You are to swear by my name. And in that connection, he says, you are not, Leviticus 19:12, you are not to swear by my name falsely. Well, the Pharisees had gotten a little bit of that. You shall not forswear yourself, they said. To forswear is to swear falsely, but you shall perform unto the Lord your oaths. But there is much hidden beneath this formula. And if you'd like to know what's hidden there, look at the 23rd chapter of Matthew, where Jesus, on that final Tuesday of the week, last week of his life, takes them apart, piece by piece. Look at verse 16, Matthew 23:16. Woe to you, you blind guides, that say whoever shall swear by the temple, it's nothing. But whoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he is obligated. You fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that has sanctified the gold? And whosoever shall swear by the altar, they say, it is nothing, but whosoever shall swear by the gift that is upon it, he is obligated, he is a debtor. You blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift. He therefore that swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. And he that swears by the temple swears by it and by him that dwells therein. And he that swears by the heavens swears by the throne of God and by him that sits thereon. In other words, there is no way to take an oath and escape the obligation that God has put upon men to tell the truth. But these were their clever devices. Why would they do such things? In order to gain advantage over somebody else? In a business deal? In order to gain the confidence of others when they intend to deceive? In order to make a false covenant? And later say, most inanely, even little children got better sense than this, I had my fingers crossed. I didn't swear. Notice I didn't swear by the gold on the temple. I didn't swear by the gift on the altar. I only swore by the altar. I only swore by the temple. It is juvenile. No, it's more than that. It's infantile. Grown men misunderstanding the will of heaven so blatantly. And Jesus says, don't swear at all. I say to you, do not swear at all, but let your yes be yes and your no, no. In other words, what I'm concerned about here is not perjury, but I'm concerned about lying. What I'm wanting is not telling the truth when you're under oath, but what I'm wanting is telling the truth always. Because the God with whom we have to do, says Titus 1 verse 2, cannot lie. And if we're going to be the children of that God, we're going to have to learn that lesson. Colossians 3 verse 9. Lie not one to another, seeing that you put off the old man with his doings. And there's a similar statement made in Ephesians, which would be expected. They are almost parallel in their outline. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 25, putting away falsehood. Speak truth with your neighbor, for you are members one of another. And of course there is Ephesians 4:15, speaking truth in love. But I think of all the warnings, all the moral precepts of the Scripture, perhaps this one is the one over which we go to sleep. I can tell you that it's possible to lie and almost not know you're lying. It's possible to dissemble, to deceive, and almost to forget and not to be aware that that's what you're doing. The law of God never gave anybody permission to lie if he's not under oath. God hates lying. And the Old Testament makes that clear. You remember that statement in Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16. Six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, lying tongue. And we ought to understand that and appreciate it. But from whence does such evil come? What is it that we need to look for that will keep us from being deceptive? Hatred of others that would cause us to twist the truth in order to make them look bad? To cause other people to look on them with animosity? To cause other people to look on them with distrust because we ourselves find them to be unacceptable? And so we're willing to bend the truth in order to get others to look on them the same way. Our own guilt, because we are guilty and because we do not want to be seen to be guilty, we bend the truth, we fracture the truth, we sometimes slaughter the truth as we tell how it was. Ask yourself if you've ever told things so as to make yourself look better than you look or that you ought to look. And covetousness can move us to the same dissembling because we stretch the truth in order to be sure that we get the financial or physical advantage we want so that in the business deal we come out better than we had hoped. selfishness and lust moves us to break the solemn vows of marriage. And that's a lie. You said, we said, we will be faithful as long as the two of us shall live. That's a commitment. You don't have to say, in the presence of God Almighty, I declare that I will keep myself to you. All you had to say when the question was asked was yes, and that's it. When we open our mouths before God, the commitment is made, the vow is sealed, and to fail to keep it is a violation of the principle that Jesus is teaching here. Thoughtlessness moves us to forget as unimportant our day-to-day promises to people. I will come and see you. We will go to the fair on Saturday. We will go to the park on Thursday. I will go with you fishing on Monday. I will do this, I will do that. But we just do it to take the pressure off us at the time and do not take seriously the promise that we made. Is this not a violation? Someone says, but it's understood, if God will. I know. But it was not the will of God that kept you away in too many instances. It was sheer indifference and thoughtlessness until your children no longer believe you when you say you're going to do something, because they've heard that before. And it didn't come to pass. Some Christians have lied away their integrity by unfounded accusations or unsupported claims for themselves, by boasting, to try to make themselves look big or successful or important. And of course, all those inflated claims usually get deflated. And when people find out that you just talk that way, that that's your disposition, that you like to do that, and you overstate the reality, then people quit listening to you. And they, of course, ought to. And some have promised away their honor by unkept commitments. Have you ever had someone say about someone else to you, well, I know they said that, but, you know, don't hold your breath. I know they made that promise, but don't count on it. It's sad when other people have to look at us that way. And it seems to me that the principle that Jesus is addressing here to help us understand the kingdom of God and the nature of God and the character of God includes that. Now somebody asks, this is the final consideration here. It does not, of course, deal with all the questions that can be raised. Do you believe, and are we to understand that this is a prohibition of any oath? It's been unfortunate that this particular section of the Scripture has led us to the question of judicial oath-taking as the first consideration. Does this mean we cannot take an oath in the civil court? I think we ought to think about many other things before we get to that. I don't think so. For years, I felt that way. And I can tell you, it would pass my throat with great difficulty to say, do you swear that certain things are true? It is a disinclination on my part. And frankly, I don't feel the need to do it if I'm allowed to do otherwise. And in this country, we are free not to swear, because there has been a strong sentiment against that on the part of some of our citizenry. I suspect it's a very small group now, but nonetheless, we are fortunate that we live in a country where that's recognized. But the Apostle Paul, in his writings, quite often calls God to witness about the truth of his statements. And even Jesus, when he was called upon to swear before Caiaphas, who adjured him by the living God, tell us whether you're the Christ or not, he answered. But you and I need to think about what we do to ourselves when we are constantly having to reinforce the confidence of other people in the truth of our statements by oaths, what that means. If we are so little to be believed because of our record, that we have always to reinforce our real commitment to this. Now, this is really the truth. Then it says something very unfortunate about us. But I do not believe that it would be wrong in circumstances where other people needed to be assured. Not because of our record, but just because they needed strong assurance. God gave His own oath, according to the 6th chapter of Hebrews, in order to give strong encouragement to His people. His promise and His oath, two immutable things, the Scripture says, that were to anchor the hope of His people. But I must say to you that I think the occasion should be few, if necessary at all. And remember that any time you say yes and any time you say no in the presence of God, the truth needs to be told. All right. Now I want to take you to a higher level in this series of six contrasts. You know, we don't always do badly when we're talking about evil in ourselves, where we do badly enough. I myself sometimes fail miserably, but I think that I must confess, and perhaps you must confess, I'll leave that to you, but I must confess that it's in the latter part of this great treatise from the mouth of the Son of God on what it means to love that I have my most miserable failures. Dealing with the evil in others. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I have to deal with my guilt. If I've mistreated other people, I've got to deal with it. Jesus says you have to. You have to go to the person you victimized. You have to go and be reconciled to him. Otherwise, your worship to me is of no benefit. It's in vain, in short. But what he comes to now in the 5th chapter, beginning with verse 38, is a teaching that simply says, if I may make it brief, that loving other people is not about justice. I mean justice for you. Loving other people is not governed and directed by whether or not you get justice. Now, we're all very willing to love other people and to be kind and to treat people right when they treat us right. But Jesus sort of nails that at the end of this 5th chapter when he says, even the Pharisee, even the publican, do that. Love those that love them. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist evil, or do not resist him that is evil. But whosoever strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other as well. And if any man would go to law with you and take away your coat, let him have your cloak also. And whoever shall compel you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him that asks from you, and from him that would borrow, do not turn away. Now, if ever you read something radical, if ever you heard something that seems incredibly impossible, if ever you've read something that on the face of it just looks like it can't be so, and that I need to find some explanation of this that'll take away the impact of it, I suppose these are the words. There have been no words ever spoken by Jesus that have caused such controversy down through the ages than the words we're reading now and the ones that we'll read in just a moment. But as we read it, I want us to remember, we want to understand what Jesus really meant. And if it is radical, it is radical. Jesus never said he wasn't radical. I will tell you in no uncertain terms that he is radical. In the purest meaning of that term, because it comes from a word which means the root of things. And he always, Jesus always goes to the root of things. These are statements that are intended to shock. I have no doubt of that. you may have questions in your mind, but I have no doubt that he frames them so as to startle the thought that if somebody is hammering me on one cheek, I should hang around and let him batter me on the other. The idea that if somebody's stealing part of my goods, I ought to let him have the rest. But I believe that there is one truth that has got to be connected and to be taken into account about these statements. That what he's talking about is not returning evil with evil. So that when he says, resist not him that is evil, I think you must add, as Paul clearly does in the 12th chapter of Romans, with evil. Now the Pharisee looked on this statement about the eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, life for life, burning for burning, which was a law to be administered by the judges of Israel. They looked on that as being a statement of the right to personal vengeance. If somebody does me injury, I have the right to do an equal injury to him. No questions asked. It's my right to do that. That's how the Pharisee understood it. The law of Moses understood that it was, yes, first of all, by design, to cause fear in the hearts of those looking on. I don't doubt that penalties exacted by law for crimes committed in any legal system, that those are intended to cause others to think. And I have never been persuaded by this argument that capital punishment doesn't make anybody think. It makes me think. The thought of imprisonment makes me think. The thought of going to jail for one day makes me think. The thought of being brought up on charges makes me think. But there's more to this than just the matter of you get punishment for wrong. What this is, as lawyers would say, a tort. That is to say, it's a limitation on the amount of retribution, the amount of punishment that the courts can exact, for a wrong done. You cannot take a man who's guilty of trespassing and send him to the electric chair. You cannot take a man who's guilty of walking on property that's not his own and cut off his hand. You can't do that. It's a limitation that's put into the statutory arrangement of the law. And the Jew said, the Pharisee said, no, it's my right to get vengeance here. And Jesus said, don't resist him that's evil with evil. Now that does not mean that you could not reprove evil. Jesus reproved and rebuked the man that slapped him in the house of Annas, 18th chapter of John. Paul and Silas refused to go out quietly when they were arrested without cause and beaten without conviction as Roman citizens in the city of Philippi. And you can read about that in the 16th chapter of Acts. And when they wanted them, having just sent their minions, their messengers down there, well, you fellows can go now. And Paul said, no. You've beaten us publicly and uncondemned as Roman citizens, and we are not going to leave quietly and secretly. And the magistrates had to come to the jail themselves. Is that a violation of this principle? I do not think so. I do not think reproof is a violation. And I will say more than that, I don't know that punishment is a violation. As long as what we do is not evil to this individual, is not to the disinterest of or not to the best interest of the individual. It must not be what you receive that you give. We return good for evil, is Paul's principle. And Paul's principle in the 12th chapter of Romans, toward the conclusion of the chapter, comes out of the teaching of Jesus. It's not wrong to run if somebody slaps you on one cheek. It's all right. It's better to run when you're struck on one cheek than to stay around and get into a bad battle. I had a lot of questions the last time I taught this material, and I had it the time before that, and I'll probably have it again, from parents who say, what am I to tell my children when they are attacked by other students? What am I to tell my son when somebody just torments and beats him every day in school? I finally told my boy, you're going to have to take care of that fellow. Well, it's difficult. Maybe if you can convince your son, and if he can be thoroughly persuaded that this is right and act out of this motivation, that the best thing that can happen to this bully is to get a taste of his own medicine. Maybe. But not vengeance. He injured me, and I'm going to make him pay. I am going to make her pay for this. Justice is going to be done here. And it's going to be exacted by me. Because I didn't get justice. And therefore, I'm going to act on the basis of the injustice done me. It's not justice that Jesus promises us. And it's not justice that we're going to always get. What we are talking about here is loving other people who do us an injury. It's not right for people to come in and steal your goods. That's not justice. But what if the person who comes in and steals your goods can only be deterred by some evil that you might do him? Or what if that individual is in desperate need of what he has taken? In which case, if the man who took our coat needs a cloak too, then let us give him the cloak. Are there any limitations on these instructions? I think if you go to the last one, you will know that that's the case. If a man asks you to borrow money, then you ought to give him the money. Is that an absolute? Not if I read 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 10, correct, when dealing with other Christians. He said, if any will not work, neither let him eat. You do a man no favor who spends his life in indolence and unconcern, who does not want to work, has no intention of working, and who uses his guile to go around trying to inveigle some money. Get some money from somebody. Please lend me some money. I need some money. Please help me out. And there's some people that do it as a lifestyle. You are destroying that individual by continuing to enable him to do that. Now, but there's another story, and this is the one we must deal with. What about the individual who does need? What about the individual who is not going to be helped along a road to laziness and indifference to his duty as a consequence of getting some help? What about when I have got the money and maybe he will never be able to pay it back, in which case I ought to say to him, no, I'm not going to lend you anything, but I'm going to give you something. In fact, I think when you know an individual has little possibility of ever paying you back for something he really needs, it makes no sense that I'm lending this to you. Better for both of us if I say, it's yours, forget it. Learning to give, and maybe the individual to whom I'm giving this has not treated me well. Maybe our past relationship has been one in which injury has been done me. But now I see this individual in difficult circumstances. And they ask, will you help me? And what am I going to say? Well, justice. Justice! Chickens come home to roost. This will teach you an important lesson. When you treat other people bad, you're going to get bad things happen to you. And I'm going to let it take its course. I'm, in fact, glad to see it. There's no love in that. And it's a violation of this principle. If someone, as they did in those days, compelled you to go a mile, and every soldier in the Roman army could do what they did with Simon of Cyrene, a perfectly decent citizen who attended to his own business on the day that Jesus was crucified, and Jesus evidently falls under the weight of his cross, and the soldiers don't want to take it up. They're not going to carry it. That would be really humiliating. So they say, here, you come and carry this. And they had to comply. And sometimes these soldiers had duties to perform that involved carrying things for distances. And they would just bring into duty any convenient citizen. And that's the reason this statement is made here. If he compels you to go with him 1 mile, go with him two. Just on the basis of, I see some people saying, okay, I've done it, that's 1 mile, but I'm saying, I don't want you, I don't need you anymore, I don't want you, I'm going 2 miles. I don't care whether you need me or not, I'm doing it, I'm going to do it 2 miles. That's not the point. It's if he needs you, if it will be good for him for you to carry the load 2 miles or to go with him 2 miles or 3 miles or whatever the case may be. We are acting not out of justice. It's not what the other individual deserves that we give. Our response is not governed by what the other individual deserves, but by what the other individual what needs. That's the reason that I want to invest this statement also with the idea of tough love. Sometimes people need tough love. Straight talk. Not out of vengeance. Not out of a sense of I'm going to see that justice is done here. But out of the need of that individual. Doing for the other individual what you'd want done for yourself. I have no doubt at all that if I could have my brothers given the enlightenment that I've received through Jesus Christ, if I was about to commit some horrible crime, that I'd be glad for somebody to knock me in the head and disable me some way to prevent me from doing that. That would be an act of compassion. Would it be wrong to do that as an act of what? Vengeance. Somebody said that's a violent act. Well, it's not violence in the sense of something that's the product of hatred or malice. It's not violence when parents discipline their children with care and with love, with a desire to train them in the right way. It is graciousness. It is mercy. It is kindness for that to be done. I'm making no defense in saying that of brutality. But I'm saying that love has often to say, no, I will not do that. Love has often to say some things that are not received by the other with any gladness. But love demands that we act out of the best interest of others in our response to evil which they may do to us. Now that's not easy. Let's just put that down. It's easy to talk about it here. It's easy to sort of lay this out in principle. But when push comes to shove and the rubber hits the road, this is not easy. Because what we want to do when other people injure us is to leave them alone. And if their cries for help are going to be just, music to our ears. Yes, indeed. Now you understand. Now you're getting the picture. And Jesus says, No. You must do good when others do evil to you. Now, he takes us to a very high pinnacle. In the last paragraph, in verse 43 and following, he said, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor but hate your enemy. And frankly, there's some things in the Old Testament that are puzzling in this connection. Ever read the 109th Psalm? The 137th Psalm? Concludes by saying that the one who beats your children head on the rock will be blessed, speaking about Babylon. The imprecatory Psalms, you've got to take a deep breath and to work through them with patience. They've not shattered my faith, but I don't always have answers about those things. It's my inclination to say that they give expression, these men who say those things in these psalms, not so much of personal vengeance, but of the justice of God who has the right to exact it in judgment upon people who are beyond help. But that may not always satisfy. But is this where the Pharisees got the notion that you ought to hate your enemy? If they did it by taking that completely out of the context of the Old Testament. I can go with you back to the period of the patriarchs and to the book of Job, who lived before there ever was a law of Moses. In the 31st chapter, where he is examining himself to determine if he's ever done anything to justify his tragic circumstances. And here's the question he asks in verse 29. Job 31:29. If I have rejoiced at the destruction of him that hated me, or lifted up myself when evil found him. He said that would be cause for all my troubles. He understood. You don't rejoice at the tragedy of your enemy. And that speaks implicitly to the attitude we're to have toward our enemies. Proverbs chapter 25. You know this well. Not from the Proverbs, but from Romans chapter 12. If your enemy hungers, says verse 21, Proverbs 25:21. If your enemy hunger, give him bread to eat. And if he be thirsty, give him water to drink. For you will heap coals of fire upon his head, and the Lord will reward you. That's what Paul said. Preaching the gospel, we ought to do. And then there's Exodus 23. You'd expect to find some support for hating your enemy right here in this righteous law. But here in Exodus 23:4, if you meet your enemy's ox or ass going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. It's the same teaching. He is your enemy not because you just don't like him, but because he has treated you unjustly. He has injured you and without cause. And now his animal is astray and you're tempted to say, aha, at last this man gets his comeuppance. And Moses said, by the Spirit of God, you are not to let that ass continue straying, but to take it back to him again. And if you see the ass of him that hates you lying under his burden, you shall forbear to leave him. You shall surely release it with him. That's the reason Jesus said, I say to you, you shall love your enemies. Now, I don't have any time left. And it's a bad time not to have any time, but I did it to myself, didn't I? This is not an emotional love. Some people say, how can you love your enemy? You don't even like them. That's right. You're not supposed to like them. I feel nothing for this man, this woman. That's right. I know you don't. You're not supposed to. This kind of love is not emotional. This kind of love is possible only as a product of sheer will. And when you have finished willing it, it doesn't bring emotion. It doesn't bring affection. It doesn't bring intimacy. It does not bring closeness. It brings only the deep resolve of your heart to act not on the basis of what he has done, but on the basis of what he needs. Not on the basis of what he deserves, but on the basis of what his needs are. That's what this love is. And it means you must do him good who did you evil. It means you must pray for him. It means it is imperative that you pray for him, because you don't need to pray for anybody so desperately in order to keep on having the right attitude toward him than your enemy, the one who has injured you. You need to pray. I need to pray for that individual so that I can bend my knee before God and say, bless this man and give him what he needs. Turn him from the course he's taking. Some loves exist only in mutuality, friendship. People are not friends because one person befriends. People are at last friends because they befriend each other. If you befriend an individual and they injure you, and they injure you again, that the friendship cannot survive. affection will not live in a situation where people don't show thoughtfulness to each other, where kindness does not operate. But this kind of love can conquer anything. There is no injury so profound. There is no brutality so great that this kind of love cannot rise up and say, I will do good. I will do good to this person. And the way we know about this kind of love is because our Father has taught it to us. Yes, He sends His rain upon the just and the unjust. But the most important truth, yet unstated in the Sermon on the Mount, but I think implicit below its surface always, God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believes on Him should not perish but have everlasting life. Stated even more to the point is Romans 5 verse 8, that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. The best we've ever been able to do is to die for the good man, to die for the righteous man. But God committed His love toward us in that while we were still unrighteous and still wicked and still